The Guardian. According to the World Health Organization, air pollution is one of the greatest environmental risks to health, with an estimated 7 million people dying prematurely every year from exposure to fine particles in polluted air. In 2015, this exposure was the fifth leading risk factor for premature death worldwide. And with 9 out of 10 of us around the world breathing air containing high levels of pollutants, the scale of the problem is enormous. A recent review concluded that air pollution may be damaging every organ in our bodies, while pollutant particles have even been found beyond the placental barrier, indicating that unborn babies are exposed to them. In this week's episode, we look at what air pollution is doing to our bodies and what needs to be done to try and tackle it.
There's a great deal of air out there, and it's very difficult to move pollutants from it once it's been diluted to concentrations that we breathe.
I'm Nicola Davis, and you're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. I caught up with The Guardian's environment editor, Damien Carrington, who, like me, has been writing about air pollution. I asked Damien to take us behind the scenes on how this issue has changed since he began working on it.
I mean, I've been writing about it for a number of years and actually kept a file which was linked to specific illnesses or specific organs or parts of the body. And it just grew and grew and grew every week, every month. You know, you were finding more connections. But then earlier this year, I wrote about a big global review which was looking at all the different impacts of air pollution, some more strongly evidenced than others. And I was talking to Dean Schraufnagel, who's at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and he explained it to me, and he said, you know, the human body evolved to fight infections, not pollutants. And what's happening now when we live in this industrialized society is that we're breathing in these things which our body doesn't really know what to do with. And so there's two sort of major mechanisms. One is the inflammation that's caused immediately in the lung, and that can spread through the body. And inflammation, as we've known for a long time, is bad for many things. But also very fine particles can quite easily transfer into the body. And I'll give you two examples. One is just recently they found soot or black carbon on the fetal side of the placenta. So it's been breathed by the mother. It's gone all the way through the body, through the placenta, which is meant to be, you know, as well as nourishing the unborn child, it also protects them. So it shows that that can get through there. And actually they've also found an iron type particle which can be produced by combustion in people's brains, and again that can be breathed through the nose. There's actually quite a close direction there. So you've got these two things. There's this kind of overall inflammation, and then also you've got this the access to all parts of the body by these very fine particles. And this review came up with the conclusion that every organ and quite possibly every cell in the body is being affected by air pollution, which is pretty scary.
We know that sort of back in the day there was the issue around the smog, and there was a big movement to clean up the air in London. But what's happened in sort of recent decades? Have we just forgotten about air pollution?
No. So air pollution in certainly, you know, kind of rich, more developed countries is often coming down in more recent years. In the UK, most of the main pollutants have been reducing, apart from ammonia, which comes from farms and causes particulate problems in cities when it blows in. But the problem is, at the same time as those levels of pollution have been coming down, our understanding of the harm that it does to the human body has started rising. And it's actually only quite recently, in the late 90s, that people really got a grip upon the science of connecting heart disease and lung diseases with air pollution, because that kind of epidemiological work takes a long time. So although in rich developed countries pollution's coming down, in lots of the developing world, of course, it's not. You know, places like India, Pakistan, China, of course, a lot of Africa as well are really polluted. And the World Health Organization says that 90% of the world's population lives in places with levels of air pollution that are above their standards.
In his book, The Invisible Killer, Dr. Gary Fuller reminds us that humans can survive for 3 weeks without food, about 3 days without water, but only for about 3 minutes without air. Gary is a senior lecturer in air pollution measurement at King's College London, and has a particular interest in using data analysis to determine if policies to reduce air pollution are actually working.
probably you'll see two or three stories a week on air pollution. There's been calls for a new Clean Air Act in the UK. We've found out about black carbon particles in placenta, for instance, and the effects that they may be having on children. And I think it's really difficult for people to pull these together as a consistent narrative. Why are we getting more of these stories at the moment? Well, I think it's just because there is more and more health evidence emerging, and that's just being reflected in the press. This is very much one of the reasons why I chose to write my book, The Invisible Killer, because I think it's very difficult for people, unless you're into it as an expert, to actually pull together a consistent narrative from the stories on health effects, the stories that we're breaking the law, the stories on new legislation, the stories on diesel cars that are polluting our cities. But there is a consistent narrative there, and it's about something that's affecting all of our lives. It's about something that's affecting people globally, and it's about something that really needs to be tackled, but we need to be discussing the evidence to ensure that we tackle it in the right way.
Perhaps we should just start by defining what we mean by air pollution. We often talk about it as though it's one thing, but it's got many components. Can you just talk me through what some of those are?
That's right. When I talk about air pollution, I talk about the air pollution that harms our health, which is a bit different to the things that affect climate change. The things that harm our health are a mixture of gases such as nitrogen dioxide, carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, and ozone when we find it at the ground level. Also, we're very concerned about small particles in the air, and we often call these according to their size. So you'll hear terms like PM for particulate matter, 10 and 2.5, and they're the size of particles in microns. And these things are really, really tiny. And when it comes to the gases, we're looking at concentrations that we measure in parts per billion. But they have a really real effect on our health.
Gary, you talked about this fine particulate matter, these sort of PM2.5s. As you say, it's defined by the size of the particle. But what are these particles made up from?
So when we measure a quantity like nitrogen dioxide, it's a defined chemical and we measure it in a specific way. When it comes to particle pollution, what we do is we collect the particles that are smaller than 2.5 microns in this case, and we just look at how much they weigh, their mass per unit volume of air. But they can be made of anything, and they are. It's kind of like going out thinking about a bag of vegetables. For instance, it might contain carrots, it might contain potatoes, it might contain peas that are really tiny. So if you would go outside and look at the PM2.5 that we're breathing, you'd find tiny soot particles from the exhausts of vehicles. You would find particles that are created from the combination of agricultural pollution, so ammonia, combining with nitrogen dioxide type products that we get from traffic anyway, so you would find ammonium nitrate. You will find lots of organic pollutants as well that sometimes are found as particles, and on hot days you will find some of these particles actually disappear and become gases, which makes it really hard to measure. Some of the particles in our air are also natural. This is more so for bigger particles than 2.5. So if we look at PM10, which is a bit bigger, we can find things like wind blown dust, occasionally in the UK, Saharan dust, and sea salt. And it is there. We can find sea salt all the way. You don't have to live by the coast to be breathing sea salt. You can find sea salt anywhere in the air in the UK and across most of Europe as well. But one of the main questions that comes from this is, given that PM2.5 consists of such a diverse range of particles with different chemical properties and physical properties in terms of just size, for instance, or shape, which are the ones that are causing us harm? And we've been spending, or the scientific community has been spending a long time trying to get to the bottom of this, because if we could find one specific type of particle, we could have smarter policies that tackled that rather than tackling all of them. But at the moment, we have many answers, but there isn't really a consensus. Some people point to the black soot particles as being the most harmful. Other studies would point to the particles that form in our air, for instance, ammonium nitrate, ammonium sulfate particles, as being the most harmful. So at the moment, we don't really know. But we do know that when the PM2.5 in a city goes up, or in places that have more PM2.5 than others, then it is affecting people's health.
And where do these pollutants come from? What sort of things are contributing to these levels?
They come from a whole range of sources. And in many ways, I think this has been one of the mistakes of the past. We've been wrestling with air pollution for 70 odd years now. Why haven't we cured it? Well, one of the reasons is that we tend to focus on just one pollution source at a time. So in the 1950s, we were concerned about coal burning at home, for instance, and the smogs. And we tried to focus on that, but we ignored all of the sulfur emissions that also came from coal, which led to the acid rain problems. While we were tackling them and tackling industry, then air pollution from transport crept under the radar and is now the thing that dominates the discussion today. But in addition to transport out there today in the air that you breathe, there's also air pollution from things that we don't normally think of, like agriculture, for instance, in the areas around London and in the near continent, industry, home heating.
Gary, you mentioned there about smog, and that's obviously a kind of air pollution that one is very aware of. You can sort of see the problem. Is there an issue about the fact that air pollution that we have outside today is invisible? I mean, is that a reason why perhaps it hasn't been talked about so much?
Yeah, air pollution is invisible, I suppose, in two ways. The first one is really that modern air pollution that we find in, you know, developed cities is actually very hard to spot. You'll spot it on a cold winter's day, as we'll have in London, you know, in a few months' time, you might see a brown haze on the horizon. But apart from that, it's quite hard to spot, and therefore you could frame it as an invisible killer. But it's invisible in another way as well, and it's invisible in the effects that it has on us. I often think that if people were to keel over in the street, let's say covered in green spots because of they'd been impacted by air pollution, then it would be much more obvious and we'd take action. But when people are dying early because of the air pollution they breathe, they're dying because of the things that people die of anyway. So they're dying from respiratory problems, they're dying from lung cancer, they're dying from strokes, for instance. And it's just shortening our lives in that way. And therefore, that's sort of invisible to us. But if you look in the health statistics, it is there.
You look at the impact of air pollution. Talk to me a bit about how you measure this in the first place.
At King's College, we run the London Air Quality Network, which is the main portal for Londoners to find out about the air that they breathe. And we use high quality reference instruments. These things can cost anything from about £10,000 to perhaps more than £100,000. And it's actually really hard to measure air pollution. During my MSc teaching last week, we all looked on Amazon and found loads of devices that purport to measure air pollution, but they don't really. What we're trying to look at is really low concentrations, that's parts per billion level, and that's really difficult to do. It's really difficult to do well anyway.
And what about variations in terms of, you know, seasons and weather and so on and so forth? Does that make it challenging as well?
It doesn't necessarily make it more challenging, and that's part, I suppose, of the things that are interesting in air pollution, is that it does have its seasons, and they're not the seasons that you might normally expect. So, for instance, if I can throw a question back at you, what time of year do you think would be the most polluted time of year in the UK?
Oh, maybe winter?
Okay, try again.
Summer.
Yeah, they're two really good guesses. Do you want to try again? You've only got two more seasons left.
Okay, I'm going to plump for autumn in that case.
No, they're all wrong. This is what normally happens when I do this with my student. People think of winter because the air is settled and we have inversions and it just doesn't disperse in our city. So very logical. Summertime, we think of Los Angeles-style smogs that we do get here and the action of the sun on air pollution. And then when people, I say no to both of those, people generally think of autumn just because it's a bit sort of dank and damp. But in fact, the most polluted time of the year in the UK and over Western Europe is springtime. Normally, we think of it as a time of renewal and new leaves and new growth. growth, but also it's a time when farmers are putting a lot of fertiliser and manure onto fields. Animals that have been kept in winter are released. And the ammonia from agriculture mixes with the air pollution from our cities, traffic and industry, and causes the types of particle pollution episodes that, for instance, cause Paris to shut down half of its car traffic on alternate days.
So talk to me a bit here about how we look at the impact of air pollution on human health. So this is also quite a complex area.
Yeah, it seems incredible that if you look into the writings from Victorian times, you'll see much about London as a smoggy city. Think of Sherlock Holmes, the writings of Dickens. It's the same for Liverpool and Manchester. But despite this, we didn't actually realise the harm that air pollution was doing. At that time, it was believed that smoke, which just filled our cities, was actually a preservative. If you think of the way that you would have preserved, let's say, meat and fish before you had refrigeration, you would have smoked it, and therefore people thought that was a preservative. And it's only really with the 1952 smog in London that we first established that air pollution was doing harm, and it did a lot of harm. A smog for a week, for the analysis at the time, they said killed 4,000 people, but the reanalysis afterwards said 12,000 people. And that, I suppose, is one of the simplest ways to study air pollution. You look for times when air pollution goes up to really high levels, and then you look to see whether there's a change in your health statistics. And this type of knowledge tells us that smogs are really harmful. The science in the 1990s looked at this in a different way, and it began to follow people over time rather than just looking at smogs. There's a very famous study called the Six Cities Study, where they studied a group of people in six cities for about 14, 15 years. And each year they wrote them a letter and said, "Are you dead yet?" And when they didn't write back, they sent out a researcher to investigate. And what they found was that people were surviving longer in some cities than others. And once they removed all the expected things from poverty and smoking, because they knew about the people, they found a differential which was explained by the pollution in their cities. So that told us that air pollution that we breathe over a period of years, day in, day out, not just the smogs, is doing us harm. The latest research is now looking at life course harm. So is a study that we've done at King's with colleagues at Queen Mary's, where we've been out in East London measuring the lung function of children. What my colleagues discovered was that the children that are living in the most polluted places are growing smaller lungs. Now, that's not completely original. It's been found elsewhere, for instance, in LA. But what that's telling us is that the air pollution that we breathe, perhaps when we're young, could be storing up a legacy of harm for the future. And so that's where the science is at the moment. I think that's probably the most concerning aspect of air pollution health evidence at the moment.
And how do you take into account other possible factors? Because there could be differences between people who live in perhaps more polluted areas and people that live in cleaner air areas. There could be other differences going on as well as the air they breathe. So how do you take that into account?
Well, I say, number one, I'm not an epidemiologist. I've worked in many epidemiology studies, but in summary, what they do is they look for contrasts. So they look for contrasts over time. So take the London 1952 episode. They look at a time when it was smoggy and a time when it wasn't. And really, it's the same people in the city. So broadly speaking, these things of, let's say, poverty, smoking, so forth, don't really change over the course of a few days. So if you like, the people in the city are self-controlling. When you compare one city to another, then it becomes more difficult, and you have to try to take into account all of the other determinants of health. There are a lot of social determinants of health, so poverty, for instance, smoking and other lifestyle factors. In some cases, if you know the people, as they did in the Six Cities study, they actually knew about the individuals. They were following a group of people. You can actually find out about these things. When you look at other larger populations, you just can't do it on an individual level. So you can either take bulk health records. Maybe you can get access to their hospital records for other things that they've been in hospital for. Or you just have to take census data. And we've got quite good census data in the UK that tells us about deprivation in one area versus another, for instance. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very difficult to always remove all of these extraneous issues.
So let's talk a bit about the health impact. So you mentioned there about these different studies and what they're looking at and some of the findings. Do we know which air pollutants are having these effects and how they're having these effects?
We feel that most of the health harm is coming from particle pollution. Going back to the Six City study that I talked about before, the clearest association that they found between how long people were living, having removed all these other factors, was with PM2.5, so that's small particles that people were breathing. We're also concerned about things like nitrogen dioxide and ozone. We often think about in terms of the ozone layer and something that's above our heads. But when we meet it at ground level, it's a really aggressive oxidizing agent. And it does a lot of harm to plants and it does a lot of harm to us as well. So they're three of the pollutants that we're concerned about. It's difficult sometimes in studies because we tend to look in our studies at one pollutant at a time. And that doesn't necessarily match the reality. Whereas you and I are sitting here, we're not just breathing PM2.5 or nitrogen dioxide. We're breathing a whole mixture. And in some ways, that really complicates the science and evidence makes it hard to disentangle which pollutant is having the effects.
After the break, we'll look at the policies that are having a positive impact on our air pollution problem and what we can do to better protect ourselves.
The way things are isn't the way they have to be.
But knowing what to challenge and how to change it isn't always clear.
That's why independent journalism has never mattered more.
When we are free to follow any lead
and question any authority,
we can confront the status quo,
uncover vital alternatives,
and bring clarity to the world's most complex issues.
We can help our readers understand the world.
So together we can fight for a better one.
Hope is power.
And with your support,
you'll always find it
at The Guardian.
Before the break, we looked at the science behind air pollution and the impact it can have on the human body. But what can we do about it? Next, we'll look at the impact regulation has had on curbing dangerous levels of air pollution. I asked Damien Carrington how effective legal limits have been so far.
I think I say they've been effective, but not effective enough. So in many well-off countries, you can see pollution levels declining, you know, not fast enough or far enough. So in the UK, for example, with nitrogen dioxide, which is a pollutant that comes from diesel vehicles mostly, we've been above the legal level since 2010, and the government's lost three times in the High Court when it's been sued as a result of that. That's one thing. You know, there are actually in the UK, our particle pollution limit is higher. That's an EU limit, is higher than the WHO recommendation. But probably the most important thing to say is that for some things, particularly the particles, a lot of scientists don't think there is any safe level. You know, it's just sort of degrees of harm. So it's not that, you know, you get to the WHO level and, oh, everything's fine. In the government's own evidence, because, you know, something like 80% of the sort of urban areas in the UK still have illegal levels of nitrogen dioxide. The new data came out today and only one district out of 80 or so, I think, had actually improved in the past year. And the government's evidence is really clear, which is that clean air zones in cities and towns are the most effective. And what that means is deterring polluting vehicles, and usually that's by charging. But the problem here has been a political one, I think, which is that central government hasn't wanted to impose charging on people entering towns and cities, which, you know, you can understand why that wouldn't be popular, at least at the start, and so have kind of pushed that onto local authorities, and local authorities say, well, we don't have the, you know, resources to make these sorts of things happen. And so, to my view, the government's been kind of squirming because they know what they need to do, but they just don't really want to do it.
So, Gary, where does the research need to go now? What questions remain and what studies would you like to see conducted?
When you talk to policymakers and politicians about this, if you give a reply that says we need more research, often what they hear is that we need more research before we take action, or that there are uncertainties and questions that remain that are barriers to taking action. And that's not the case. When it comes to air pollution, we have ample evidence in many, many thousands of studies that have been done worldwide, most of them showing that air pollution is affecting our health, though not all. Together, this provides a huge evidence base that says that we do need to take action now. So really, I would say, yes, we do need more research, but we do most of all need to look at the research evidence that we have now and use that as an imperative for action.
Are there particular gaps that you think would be interesting to explore?
I think there's some pollutants that we haven't been looking at quite tightly enough. One of them relates to particle pollution. What we normally do is we weigh the mass of particles in the air, whereas if you were to look more closely at the really tiny particles, they don't weigh very much, but there's some emerging evidence that they might be having health effects. And this would lead us to looking at different sources. So this would lead us to looking much more at aircraft, much more looking at cooking, for instance, that aren't on our radar. There's also some things that aren't on our policy radar. So whilst we've been cleaning up the exhausts of vehicles, for instance, we haven't really been taking action on the particles that come from the wear processes. So if you think you might own a car, and if you do, you'll be renewing its tyres maybe every 25,000 miles, you'll be renewing its brake discs or pads as well. And a lot of that material that wears away actually goes into the air and we breathe it. And this is largely unregulated.
What can we do to improve our air quality? Have there been examples of policies that have worked really well?
There are loads of examples of things that have worked well to improve our air pollution, and they all involve tackling air pollution at source. For instance, London doesn't look like it did in the 1950s. We tackled a source, which was home heating with solid fuels. Yeah, and we tackled the smoke problems there. Some of the acid rain problems of the 1970s and 1980s, they're not as severe now as they were before because we tackled the source. We improved air pollution from industry. At the moment, we are having, let's say, slow progress in tackling air pollution from traffic. And a lot of this comes down to diesel vehicles and the way in which diesel vehicles have passed regulatory tests when they're run, if you like, on treadmills in laboratories. And then when they're taken out into the streets, they operate in a different way and emit much more air pollution than they do when they're tested in the labs. So that's really slowed down progress. There are some solutions out there that we should be wary of. Some of these solutions suggest that we try to clean the air after it's already been polluted. And there's a great deal of air out there, and it's very difficult to move pollutants from it once it's been diluted to concentrations that we breathe. It's much easier to tackle it at source, where the pollution is a lot more concentrated and is generally only in one place. When it comes to cleaning the outside air, I often use the analogy of trying to take the milk out of your cup of tea. It's really, really difficult to do. And the answer is, don't put the milk in it in the first place if you want black tea. And there are many solutions that we need to be wary of. For instance, smog towers that have been appearing in Chinese cities, some of the green walls that are being put in place around schools, and some of the other things that just, you know, surfaces that react with air pollution to try to scrub it. I think we need to be wary of those, and they might just be not the best way to spend our money.
A lot of the measures you're talking about here are certainly sort of, you know, government enacted policy type decisions. Is there anything that individuals can do? I mean, we can't all move house and we can't all work somewhere that's, you know, not a city. How can we protect our own health?
Or even if you go to the countryside, there could be a lot of air pollution there. The first thing, there is things that we can do. We've been doing a lot of work with businesses in London and working on clean air walking routes, for instance. Think about the routes and the way in which you travel around. There's some other aspects of this that people in cars often experience more air pollution than cyclists or people that are walking. So if you think about the way in which you travel around, then you can reduce your exposure. But then also think about the role in which you play and try to be less part of the problem. 40% of journeys that are made by car in England are less than 2 miles, so 3 kilometres. Most people can easily walk or cycle this faster than they would be able to drive. So lots of studies have shown that even if we were to swap just a small bit of distance that we travel by car for walking or cycling, then we can do something to help air pollution. I think looking forward, we need to think differently about our cities. Our cities, as been pointed out, weren't, for many of us in the developed world, they weren't built for cars, they were built for people. But yet our streets are clogged with vehicles. And there's a tendency to build more and more roads. And as we know from the experience of the M25, the Westway in London, and motorways and bypasses all over the place, they don't really cure the traffic problem. So some of the exciting things that I've seen is, well, perhaps we can work it in the opposite way, in the way that increasing road capacity actually induces more people to travel or encourages people to travel further. The opposite has been found as well. So if we actually start removing road capacity, then we might be able to reduce the amount of traffic in our cities and improve our lifestyles. For instance, if you go to Seoul in South Korea, there was a multi-lane highway that used to go into the city. We're talking 6 or 8 lanes on either side. And this delivered a load of traffic into the city centre, which was hopelessly congested. So rather than building more roads, what the city authorities did was they actually removed this major road. In doing so, they uncovered a river that had been buried beneath it decades before. And now the people have a space where they can get outside and enjoy their city. And they have a green transport corridor that can take them into the city centre. So perhaps we should be thinking a bit more along those lines. We should be thinking about how we can redesign our cities such that walking and cycling, for those of us that can do it, becomes the natural way to travel, so our kids can play outside safely and enjoy the environment around them.
I finished by asking Gary Fuller whether there's room for optimism when it comes to tackling air pollution.
A lot of the things that we talk about with air pollution are about how much it's impacting on our health or how much we're not meeting legal guidelines. And I think there's a responsibility, if we're going to move forward, there's a responsibility for scientists to help us map out something more positive. And people are taking action. In the last year, we've seen movements like Extinction Rebellion, and we've seen the school strikes for climate. And okay, they're associated with climate change. But also, if you look at the banners, people are campaigning under that for air pollution as well, and to clean up the air that they breathe. I think some of the most exciting things are actually happening around schools. We have the School Streets movement in the UK, where parents and teachers are getting together to close the roads outside their children's schools when they kids are being delivered for road safety and also to reduce their air pollution exposure. Also, if you look at car sales, you'll see lots of statistics from the motor industry that diesel cars are just being left in the showrooms. So people are voting with their wallets as well. So there are lots of reasons to be positive. Mass opinion is changing that we really need action in this area.
Big thanks to Gary Fuller and Damien Carrington for joining me this week. There are links to Gary's book, The Invisible Killer, on the episode page of this podcast, along with pieces by Damien and me for The Guardian. You'll also find a link to the London Air Quality Network, which Gary helped to develop, and allows our London listeners to track location-specific quality of air. But until next time, goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.